Box to Box Stoppage Time.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Great savings every day.
And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices.
Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Hello and welcome to Box Stoppage Time, a show where over the next 25 minutes we'll wrap the week in world football through the games, teams and hot topics that have caught our eyes over those 7 days. Derek Dyson is back after a spell on the Stoppage Time bench. He's out at the Healesville Sanctuary with the new ball in hand as always. Derek, welcome and please do launch into your game of the week for us.
Thank you, Willem. Yeah, good to be back and I hope my game of the week isn't dated too much by the time this goes to air. I did spend a bit of time in America recently, and I've gone for a Copa America game, and that was Argentina versus Ecuador. And of course, Argentina are now in the semi-finals. We may already have had those by the time that this has gone to air. But it was a pulsating game. It was 1-1 after normal time, and obviously the match, as they do in this Copa America, goes straight to penalties, where the narratives really start, and Rob mentioned it, of course, in the main show. Lionel Messi went up first, and his Panenka hit the bar. And it just made me think about Messi. I think we've mentioned it on the show before. Why can't Messi take penalties? He's the greatest player to have ever played the game. In my head, that's pretty clear. You know, he's tried a whole, you know, range of penalties over his career. I think I've seen him take a Panenka once before, but he's really bad. I think his record is about 75% conversion rate, or 3-4, which on the surface doesn't sound too bad. But for a player of his caliber and his experience, like, he should be scoring nearly every penalty that he takes. He doesn't seem to follow any of the modern penalty taking styles that we were marveling over with England recently. He doesn't do the checked run up or the slow run up. He doesn't watch the goalkeeper. He doesn't go hard and low or high. It's usually just a placement, a goalkeeper. But at least he tried a Panenka with this new one, and it was a bit reminiscent of Zidane taking a big one a few years ago, but he hit the underside of the bar and it went in. This one didn't. It could have been a real problem for Argentina, but thankfully, Emi Martinez saved the first two spot kicks. And he, to be honest with you, I think he's been the player of the tournament for Argentina, their player of the tournament, Martinez. You may not like his personal style at times, but he is a fabulous goalkeeper, a big, big tournament goalkeeper. And it was Julian Alvarez, Alexis McAllister, who got the job done for Argentina. So, yes, they'll probably have played Canada by now, guys. Will be interesting to see whether they get through, but the Messi penalty conundrum continues. Why is he so bad?
Yeah, if the best player in the history doesn't have the answer, Derek, I sure as hell don't. Just quickly, did you ever think Martinez had him in it all those years he was sitting on the bench at Arsenal as a number two? Did you ever think, yeah, he had it in him to be a good number one, maybe even an international keeper, but he's just about the best keeper in the world and he's right in the mixer, as we record, to win perhaps a third consecutive major title, if you like?
Yeah, the answer is no. I mean, he goes way back to Arsene Wenger days, and we got used to having a string of particularly underwhelming second-choice goalkeepers at Arsenal. A good second choice was very few and far between for us. So, yeah, I would have remembered him being announced for, like, you know, League Cup games or whatever, sort of semi-ironic cheering when his name was called out. So, no, absolutely not. I mean, he's definitely grown. He is now a big man. I think when he started at Arsenal, he was a bit more lithe. But he is a big, wide, tall, intimidating goalkeeper. And the amount of kind of one-on-ones, not just the penalty shootout, you know, one-on-ones that he's stopped and beaten the ball away, he just makes that goal look absolutely tiny when you're bearing down on goal. So, no, he's a magnificent goalkeeper. And no, I didn't see it coming.
My game of the week is the Netherlands against Turkey, which I took in at a 72nd birthday party down in the south of the Netherlands in Tilburg with a relative of mine and all of her boomen, all her neighbours and her friends and family. Classic game of two halves, I thought, with Turkey opening up through Samet Akkadan. And we were messaging as this one went on edge. This was criminal from Denzel Dumfries. Like, really terrible to concede that corner. He thought it was a goal kick, but it had very clearly taken a hit off a teammate with no other players around him. And and then from the resultant corner, played three of them onside, including Akaden, who nodded it in. And the front four just doesn't work. Xavi Simons and Depay in the centre, so flat. There's no overlap. There's no angles to play the ball into. And Koeman gets a bit of stick for being a bit tactically dull. And he does have one plan B up his sleeve, and he pulled it straight away with Wout Weghorst on. And he gets a lot of stick, the big man, but it looks a hell of a lot better. And in the second half, they worked their way back into it really nicely and, yeah, really do look a different side. Scored from a corner through Stefan de Vrij. And Derek speaks of Martinez putting on a bit of size and presence. Remember de Vrij, a little stick in the centre of the touch defence edge when Tim Cahill stuck that one in 2014. At 32 now, having spent a lot of time at Inter Milan, he's become a player that I just didn't see having that potential in him. And he's keeping out Matthijs de Ligt in the prime of his career. He's been excellent, de Vrij.
Certainly has been. And I just think your boys, Willem, were lucky that they copped Turkey, because Turkey, when they went the goal ahead, I think we were messaging at the time, I just couldn't see them holding on. They did put players behind the ball to try and stifle the creativity of Holland. But yeah, as it turned out, as you mentioned, the second half, the Dutch were able to turn the tables. And a bit sorry to see Turkiyez. I know you want Holland to win, but I was a bit sorry to see Turkiyez's run come to an end. They were good value through the tournament, very entertaining, great emotion, great fan base. They added a lot to this tournament, didn't they, Willem?
No, they didn't. I think we've seen how even it is with teams having big historic results and then just being unable to back it up. Austria beat the Dutch and then lost to Turkey. Turkey beat Austria, who were in red hot form, and then, yeah, just weren't able to back it up across the full 90 minutes here. And after De Vrij's header, it was Cody Gakpo, who's been awesome, not credited with the goal. It was an own goal to Mert Mulder, but very much created by the Liverpool man. But from there, Turkey did come back and the Dutch had some serious defending to do. And I think goalkeeper Verbruggen has made himself a little bit of a national hero. He's only 21. He's played one season fully for Anderlecht and 20-odd games for Brighton. But yeah, he could well be the national goalkeeper for a long time to come. And he came up big twice. And then to sort of round it out nicely, there was an awesome bit of defending from Dumfries, a big sliding defensive block to put right his first error. And we'll just fade up this tune, Adam. This is Bavada Engel, or Engel Bavada, which is Guardian Angel, and then this has been turned into Aranya Bavada, the Guardian of the Dutch. This song is absolutely everywhere at the minute.
Het wordt prachtig, net als in 1988. Ik weet nu ook.
Know this one, Michael?
Yeah, I know the tune. I can't say I understand the words.
All right, well, can we understand your words as we move forward? And
it's a bit of a change, at least from Free From Desire and Bloody Sweet Caroline, which I'm getting a bit fed up of now. And it's not just England; it's every team has adopted these songs now. So I'm all up for the difference. A bit of change, Willem.
Shifting off the run sheet, Derek. You mentioned that the opening ceremony was just terrible, and the sort of livery and the design around the broadcast, just the sort of very generic Euro 2024 with the We On Fire song. Are we in a post-effort era when it comes to the sort of colour and life around a tournament? Think back to South Africa or, you know, how good those songs were. And just taking in a tournament, Brazil 2014 looked really good visually. I think we're just absolutely well past it.
Oh, look, I think you're right. I think, like, as a visual package, it's not particularly interesting from a broadcast point of view. I tell you what, though, the fans have really brought it, haven't they? I mean, seeing those banks of yellow, the Georgian fans, the orange, even the England fans, like, this is why the Euros is so good, isn't it, Edge? Because it just brings these amazing groups of people from all over, a very small sort of geography, and just shows the rich history and diversity of the country. And I think the fans have been absolutely outstanding, and they've really lifted the package.
Oh, they have, haven't they? They've been much more than any sort of previous FIFA World Cup that I've seen. The fans have been a real core component of the match day coverage. You can see the directors in the outside broadcast booths cutting to the fans a lot after goals and doing the slow-mo replays. And there's something to be said about the Euros, because so many of these countries are within driving distance of where people live. So it's a lot more affordable to get to for the traditional, you know, rusted on, you know, passionate fan. And it's just been fantastic to see. And I'm really pleased that the host broadcast has really embraced getting the fandom into the match day experience. Have you noticed that, Willem?
No, absolutely. And we're going to stick with you here with some more Euros. What have you got for us? Is this your team or your game? You've been bending and flexing the rules a little bit. What have you got for us?
I'm sacking the game of the week because I've got I need the time for my hot topic, which is the Matildas alumni. But my team of the week is England, because everybody who listens to this will know that I'm really watching closely the relationship between the media and the English players. And I was really surprised. I think we talked about this goes back a little bit to Jude Bellingham. I was really surprised to see him after the Slovakia game, where he scored that important equaliser, which he was incredibly emotional about afterwards. After that game, he talked about it was good to sort of give a bit back to the fans who'd been giving such a big pile-on, which I was a bit surprised at, that he used the word pile-on. He definitely wanted to get something off his chest that was... he said, you hear people talk a lot of rubbish. It's nice that then when you deliver, you can give them a little bit back. When he was sort of asked to clarify what he meant by rubbish, and he said he feels like there's a bit of a pylon, and that for moments like that, it's nice to throw it back into some people's faces. So they were pretty strong words from Bellingham. So they're obviously, Derek, the English are creating a siege mentality, aren't they? And I just wonder whether that's healthy. And, you know, I don't think the media's been too unfair on them in this tournament, especially comparatively to previous tournaments. What do you think?
Well, the BBC coverage for the last game has been absolutely scathing criticism of that, because people have said that they've gone the other way and they're at halftime absolutely raving about the England performance as they were drawing 0-0 with Switzerland. It sounds like, felt like someone maybe upstairs in the BBC had come down and said, look, we need to have a bit more positivity with a national broadcaster here, and you know, et cetera. You know, yes, Southgate has made it his business to mend that rift between the players and the media. It became so self-destructive under Ericsson, Capello, Steve McLaren, Graham Taylor. You can go back as far as that. And, you know, the journalists are now playing darts with the England players, and they're much more available for interviews and profile pieces, etc. But, you know, Gareth obviously decided that the gloves are off as far as that's concerned. And obviously combined with the, you know, having beer thrown at him and plastic cups thrown at him, it's a bit of a siege mentality with the fans as well. I mean, it all seemed well after the penalty shootout. The fans behind the goal were delirious. But yeah, I think, you know, the players and Gareth Southgate are bristling a bit, because they're in the semi-final of a tournament. They're in the third semi-final in 4 years. Statistically, Gareth Southgate is England's most successful manager, and yet they can't do anything right. But, you know, the performances have been extremely poor, and the criticism has been there. So yeah, they're probably trying to galvanise internally, Edge.
Well, I'll just leave it before we go on to the your team of the week, Willem and Derek. I'll leave it to Gary Neville. Gary Neville, a veteran of 5 major tournaments for England, another 3 as coach. So he's been there. His comments were really interesting. He said, they've started to sound like England players of the past, referring to outside criticism. He said, lads, get your innocence back. Get your love for tournament football back. Nobody wants you to lose. They've started to listen to things that are happening externally, but nobody's been criticised personally. Nobody's questioning their character. No one said they're not working hard. All we've said, they're not playing football very well. The football criticism is fair criticism. So obviously the media also responding to the way the players are responding to them. I don't know whether you can say that.
Starting to sound like England players of the past, a la me, and now he's speaking as an older man with hindsight outside of the system. I'm not sure that works. Gaza.
Yeah, you're probably right, Willem, but it's interesting stuff for us, though, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Geez, I hope they lose. Derek, Vivian Miedema on her way to Man City from Arsenal, and they are your team of the week.
Yeah, I suppose it's an ironic team of the week, really, because I'm a bit bitter, and I've gone, well done, Manchester City women, because they've signed Vivian Miedema, as you said, on a free transfer. After her contract expired with Arsenal, as you said in the main show, she's the Women's Super League top goal scorer of all time, 79 goals. She scored 125 for Arsenal in total, 50 assists in 172 appearances for Arsenal. She's essentially the Bergkamp of her generation. When she signed in 2017 for Munich as a Euros winner, Arsenal had pulled off a real coup, and she has been up there frequently as top 5-10 female footballers in the world. But that has all come to an end. The former Australian Arsenal manager, Joe Montemurro and Medemar, had a great relationship, it doesn't seem that the same is true of Jonas Edervall, who does come in for criticism from all counts. They don't see eye to eye. There is friction there. They often seen having animated discussions during and after games. So, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes, Edge. We can only look at it as fans. But, you know, is this one of the more stranger decisions that Arsenal women have made in their transfer policy in recent years?
Well, I don't think they made the decision. I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think there's friction between the coach and the player, and the player said, I want out, and they've come out of contract and they've disappeared to a rival. And as a fan, that's probably the worst way a player can leave, isn't it? When I think everybody in the game realises they probably should keep her, and if they were going to be successful, they would have added players around her. I'm in the camp that probably the coach has himself to blame in relation to this one, and it's probably going to bite him on the backside when she plays against them.
Yeah, there is another school of thought that she doesn't quite fit into Edvard's style of play. You know, she can play a number 9, number 10, but Arsenal do have a Sweden international, Blackstenius. He's an excellent target player, and they went all out to tempt Alicia Russo on a free transfer from Manchester United at the beginning of last season. So potentially there's just no room at the inn. But I'm just very sad. She's a superb footballer, and Arsenal need to grow on what was a pretty disappointing campaign last year. They were knocked out of the Champions League in the qualifying rounds. They didn't really get close in the Super League, and the Continental Cup really saved Jonas Erdevall's season. I hope they know what they're doing. And it'll be interesting to see how she goes in Sky Blue.
My team of the week are the Australian Joeys, winners of the Under-16 Boys Championship in Indonesia. Brad Maloney's side winning it 8-7 on penalties after a 1-1 draw with Thailand in the final. Quinn McNichol edge on the score sheet for the 6th time this tournament. That means that he shares the tournament golden boot with Anthony Didelica, 6 apiece. Their tournament, as a quick run-through, was 0-0 against Thailand, 2-0 against Malaysia, and then 12-0 against Timor-Leste, in which both of those aforementioned boys scored 4 apiece. That was the group stage. They then were a little bit sloppy defensively, but won 5-3 in the semi-final against Indonesia before the final against Thailand. To the shootout, Jay Janovic, a young boy on the books of the Mariners, he saved two penalties in the shootout before Melbourne City's Jaden Nasovsky buried the winner. So congratulations to those two boys. Derek, did you want to quickly jump in with your hot topic before we clear the decks and Edge can roll on with his... Yeah, very important and well-publicised hot topic.
Yeah, I will do, Willem. I was just reflecting on my trip recently to the US, and I wanted to compare notes with Edge. You know, granted, I wasn't there long, and I wasn't there in a football capacity, but I was there mixing with plenty of Americans, professional people of about my age. I don't think I encountered one person who was either aware that the Copa America was on, or B, that the US were playing in the Copa America, or C, that the US were hosting the Copa America. I forgave them for not knowing that the Cricket World Cup was going on in the USA. I did point out that that was also happening. But the level of Copa America knowledge from Americans on the ground, as far as I could see, was pretty thin on the ground. I saw a lot of shirts for other teams. I was walking around, I could see Mexican shirts, Colombia shirts, Argentina shirts, Messi shirts everywhere I went in America. We obviously saw some poor appearance, attendances edge for the US men's team. They obviously crashed out of the tournament in some ignominy, but this has been seen as a build up to the big deal, the big dance in 2 years from now. So just brief comments from you on whether that tallies with what you found in America. Was I just in the wrong bars and in the wrong corridors here? Have they got a bit of work to do to build some enthusiasm around this men's team?
I just think that with America, it's a bit of a general comment, but the diaspora in America or the immigrants in America are sort of, you know, they're moving to America for a better life, a better employment opportunity. They don't necessarily want to embrace the patriotism of the USA in the context of supporting the football team, because if they're from Mexico, or most of the immigrants obviously are from Latin America and South America, and if you're from those nations, you are more proud of your Mexican team or your Argentinian team or your Costa Rican team than you are of the US. So I think the football in America is popular with the migrants in particular, and that's the audience that's queued into Copa America. The mainstream Americans are not terribly enthralled with the performances of their men's national team. If it was the women's team, it would be a different story, because when the women are playing in America, when I've been in America and the women are playing, it is mainstream news. They're on the back page of a newspaper. They're you know, first or second news story on the nightly news in the sports segment. Not the case for the men's team. And that's what you've described is consistent with my experiences over there. But it's more that, even Americans of second and third generation, you know, Latino heritage supporting the Latino teams in much greater fervor than they are the US.
All right, Edge, floor is yours for your hot topic.
Well, I just thought that there's been a big announcement a week ago thereabouts that Football Australia would recognise what's loosely known in the football community as the 75ers. Effectively, a team that was 95% chosen from the one club, St George, in 1975, that went across to Hong Kong and played in the precursor of what's the current AFC Asian Cup for women. It was an invitational tournament at the time. Football Australia over the years had dealt with representations that were made by the group of 75ers and their advocates that they deserve to be known as the first Matildas. Football Australia in years gone by twice had effectively made decisions to not notice them as the first Matildas, and that was the first Matildas were the ones from 1978. And obviously we all know Julie Dolan was the first Matildas captain, and she's also recognised her status in the game with the Dolan Medal, which is the medal for the best player in the A-League women's competition, to recognise her role in the game. So Football Australia made this announcement, but the announcement was overshadowed by the response of the Matildas alumni. And in particular, let's start with Julie Dolan. She said on the day that this was announced that that this decision made a mockery of national team selection processes and was nothing short of farcical. And the interesting perspective of Julie Dolan is that she was part of that St George team in 1975 as a 14-year-old, and she went to great lengths to explain in an article written by Vince Regari that it was a club team that was basically one night after training, the coach announced, oh, look, we've been given an opportunity to go to Hong Kong, and no one ever thought that they were representing Australia. What's interesting is that Football Australia had reopened this issue, had a process, and then made an announcement. And I thought we'd borrow from Tracy Holmes's great podcast, The Sports Ambassador. If you're not a subscriber, you should be. It's only $10 a month. And Tracy's gone in. There's about an hour and a half of interviews of important stakeholders around this. And I thought we would clip up a little bits and pieces just to shed light on just how significant an issue this has become in the women's game. Let's firstly go to the president of the Matildas alumni. Her name is Renee Issonet, and this is her comments about the decision.
Yeah, look, it absolutely took myself by surprise and many, many alumni, given that the previous board at Football Australia had overruled twice that they were not a full national team. They were, in fact, a club team. And I know that last year that they were were offered and bought and offered the, to come in as an alumni in the fold as Australian alumni and be offered unnumbered caps, which I believe they refused 12 months ago.
So she references the previous decisions of Football Australia's board, which seems to be a major contention of the Matildas alumni, and Football Australia chairperson Anta Isaac, who's only 3 or 4 months into, or 5 months into the job. He had this to say about the previous decisions.
Maybe that was a critique of the previous process, that we relied on this panel of historians with limited information to almost make the decision on behalf of a board. And I don't think that's good governance, actually, for the board to delegate a decision to a panel of historians.
So Isaac's made it pretty clear that he viewed the previous decision as flawed. The story goes on. So here's Renee Isareff again, the president of the Matildas alumni, on the reaction from the Matildas alumni, the past players of the Matildas, to this announcement.
Any alumni I've spoken to had correspondence with by message, phone call, and there's been a lot. Just can't believe it. It's quite unbelievable that this has happened. It has come as a big shock, and not understanding how this is to be.
So obviously, Tracy Holmes put to Anta Isaac, the chairman of Football Australia, just what has been his response to effectively the negative response from the Matildas alumni. And this is what the chairman of Football Australia had to say.
I think we're surprised by the extent of the criticism received, especially given that this Matildas, you know, the brand, women's football, the journey, the story of you know, how it's evolved over time, the kind of obstacles that they've had to overcome, and, you know, different generations of footballers and administrators and coaches, you know, they've each individually played a part in dismantling the bricks of walls maybe that have obstructed the growth of the game. And to all of a sudden see this brand, which has been built on inclusivity, and all of a sudden have this kind of outlier, you know, maybe a group or a sentiment which is very evidently exclusionary, I think that's the most disappointing part. And I think, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, I think even a lot of the people who, you know, we've known for a long time, who have been quite critical, I think with the benefit of hindsight, they'll look back and maybe be a bit regretful for some of the comments they've made.
We might just pause there for a moment. I'll just ask Willem a question. He's been listening, but I don't think he would Isaac's characterising the criticism as coming from sort of a minority or a slither of the community in the women's football. I don't think you'd call Julie Dolan an outlier in any way, would you?
No, and I think you want to be careful about being in an argument of any kind at any point in life and saying in time you will regret this. I don't think that is ever going to go down particularly well. I think it's, and I know you've got more of it to play out here, Edge, but I think it's tracking one way, and that it will be rescinded from Football Australia. If there were one or two who liked it and didn't like it, well, then, you know, you're not going to keep everyone happy. But I think the force and the number, it's, you know, somewhat democratic in the amount of votes that have come this way, pushing back against the decision, I think is pushing it a certain way. Before you do pick up, again, Edge, Derek wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, Edge, two questions for me. Why is this something that they've done? So, because I'm coming at this very, very loose, you know, very top level here, but why is this issue of this game, why was it so important for the Australian Association to clarify? And why did they not do any wider consultation as far as we can tell around the decision? Because it, you know, that the, there can't be idiots. They must have known that something of this nature was going to be quite controversial, and it didn't take long for the leading voices in the women's game to latch onto it. You know, it surely can't, yeah. So why is it important, and why didn't they do any research?
Isaac, in his interview with Tracy Holmes on the Sports Ambassador podcast, says that FIFA, and in particular the AFC and the historical records, had in 2022 decided that the tournament that the St. George team played in was in fact the beginnings of the Asian Women's Cup, and therefore they're recognising as Australian national teams. And it appears that the current board has taken issue with history experts that Football Australia relied on previously. And Isaac mentions in that interview that they potentially didn't have all the information. So that's what it's about. But it doesn't sort of address the main sort of queries and gripes that the Matildas alumni have. And I guess this one in particular is extremely cutting, and I think any independent observer would really feel for this person. This person's name is Dr. Karen Menzies, who is, until the announcement, was the first Indigenous Matilda, and she was also for 3 years a member of the Football Australia Indigenous Advisory Group, and for the past 12 months has been the co-chair. So I think, Derek, why don't you listen to this and then we'll get your instant response to what she had to say.
I was first alerted about the Football Australia decision by former Matildas alumni, Renee Isereff, who was kind of checking in on me. I don't do social media, so I wasn't aware of what had happened. And basically what Renee was wanting to check in about is that my position as the first Indigenous Matilda has now changed, and I'm down the order to second, which is fine. I don't have an issue with it. It's just the process that I'm concerned about, that they haven't acted in a transparent and ethical way, and especially as far as my role on the National Indigenous Advisory Group. So I was appointed to that position in September 2021. Yeah, I was appointed in September 2021, so nearly 3 years. I stepped down last month. But for the last year, I've actually been the co-chair. And so this decision that was made by the board, I've met a number of the board members. I've been to meetings in person and online. So I just felt that there was complete disregard for my feelings. Whatever decision they made, it just was a demonstration of colossal disrespect, I think. And I've contacted the secretariat of the National Indigenous Advisory Group that is part of Football Australia, as I said, the group that I've been a part of for the last 3 years until last month, and they hadn't been informed either. And so, you know, it doesn't actually give them an opportunity to make a comment to Anita Rita's family. It doesn't give them a comment to consider whether this has been a process that they think has been delivered and dissected in an appropriate way. So I just think the lack of communication is alarming in the way that this decision has been made.
So, Derek, I don't know, when I first heard that, I just thought that lady, Dr. Karen Menzies, volunteering her time on the Indigenous Advisory Group of Football Australia, the co-chair, was, until this announcement, was recognised as the first Indigenous Matilda, and nobody talked to her. You can feel the hurt in her voice. It's just, I'm quite astonished, actually. I don't have any words for that.
Yeah, look, I've got to be careful because I don't know enough about it. I'm just making, you know, taking pot shots from the side, but you know, all I'm getting is that when we heard the response, and look, fair play, the person from Football Australia went on and and spoke about it, but it was a male voice I was hearing talking about the women's game, decisions being made about the women's game, and the perception that it gives to me is that, you know, that for whatever reason, that a decision like this, which seems pretty fundamental and monumental to so many different people, I hadn't thought of this angle with the first Indigenous player. I was just thinking about all the other women who thought they were the first Matildas, and that this arbitrary decision had been made, in some kind of stuffy board type environment. And it's just the voice coming from Football Australia as a man, that kind of disturbs me a little bit. So I know that, you know, the CEO or the chairman has to be either male or female and whatever, but when you listen to her voice again, it just to me, as just someone who is a leader in business, someone you're thinking about your stakeholders and consultation, and you just know how febrile this community can get and how kind of active they can be. It just seems like they've taken a decision without any consideration or due thought for the people involved. It smacks, I don't know, it's not the same organizations, is it? But the decision to move all the finals to Sydney, and then everyone losing their shits about that as well. Just these arbitrary decisions that I think people think they're making really good decisions, but they're just not thinking about it in a kind of deep or thorough way. So I don't know if what I've said has made any sense. I'm just a punter from the sideline, but that's my interpretation.
It's an interesting view. I think a lot of people would identify with it. Let's just leave the last comments. In fairness to Football Australia's chairman, Ant Isaac, he's feeling for the 75ers who for a long time have advocated that they're the first Matildas. And this is what he has to say about inclusion.
What I would say is for any of the people who are criticising the decision, I'm hoping it's not happening because of, you know, some kind of personal agendas and so forth, that they embrace this decision, that they welcome these 75ers warmly, because, you know, that they also overcame incredible obstacles and challenges to do what they did, right? That they are completely part of the story of the Matildas we celebrate now. And that brand is built on inclusion, right? And this recent sentiment is anything but that, and we need to immediately, distance ourselves from that kind of sentiment and mood and start moving towards, you know, how we can embrace the 75ers and celebrate them.
Well, we might just leave the last word to this to the president of the Matildas alumni, Renee Isseriff, and then we'll wrap it up.
We're just hoping to have a voice and to be heard as alumni, to be included and considered. We weren't really considered when these decisions were being made, and the 75ers were, and that's okay. They were considered. They had a voice. They had people fighting for them. They had, you know, people within the Federation accept and acknowledge it and bring them in. But alumni that have been the future, the history of our game since the 70s, we just didn't feel included. We should have, I feel, and many alumni do, feel perhaps we should have been brought in on these conversations and given a choice, a chance to have a voice at the table.
Well, that is sort of a summary of what's an extremely emotional and hot issue at the moment. It definitely qualifies as a hot topic, doesn't it, Willem? And I don't think we've seen the end of it. I think this is going to be a PR bomb for Football Australia for quite a while, unless it's dealt with quite delicately. So, yeah, watch this space. Will they rescind the decision? I don't know if they will or they won't, but they probably should give it some good consideration.
I've done a great job. Their edge laid it out very comprehensively. And yeah, you say that we doesn't really feel like we're near a resolution. It feels closer to the start, and we feel a long, long way from consensus and inclusion, whichever side of the fence a 75er or an original Matilda, if you take my point, might feel on the side of. We hear Ant Isaac speaking there about inclusion and inclusivity, and it doesn't feel like that's where we're at the minute. So as I say, you've done an excellent job in laying all of that out, Edge, and listeners, I'm sure now are more than equipped to at least consider it a little bit more deeply and consider all sides. It does bring us to the end of stoppage time for another week. Thank you very much to you two gentlemen and to Adam Maloney for clipping up a few more audio grabs than is usual. He's earned his keep this week. In the meantime, please do follow us on X. You can like us on Facebook. You can enjoy our written content at boxtobox.com.au. And please do join us once again on Monday. Rob Gilbert's going to be back. We're going to wrap the finals of both the Copa and the Euros as we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Cup.